Next on News for the Soul, Indigenous Perspectives with Diane. Diane Hill is a member of the Bear Clan of the Mohawk Nation, situated at the Six Nations of the Grand River Territory in Ontario. She works as an integrative programs consultant at the Real School Leadership Program. She's also the director, owner, and operator of a private healing lodge and learning center focused on healing and fostering emergence of the good mind. Her passion is to teach, empower, and bridge the Western allopathic scientific perspective with the ancient, indigenous, multidimensional approach to wholeness. Please welcome Diane back to News for the Soul.
Nicole Whitney, News for the Soul, life-changing talk radio from the uplifting to the unexplained. Yeah, it's a great honor to have you on the show tonight. Welcome, Deepak Chopra.
Thank you.
Yes, this is Uri.
Hi, Uri. It's Nicole Whitney calling News for the Soul. Welcome to News for the Soul, Robert Allen.
Thank you, Nicole. It's great to be here with you tonight.
Why are you here? We're talking to Carolyn Mace about Sacred Contracts, one of her many best-selling books. Welcome to the show, Greg Braden.
Well, good evening, Nicole. It's certainly a pleasure to hear your voice and a pleasure to be here tonight.
Hear all of our previously aired broadcasts of News for the Soul online at newsforthesoul.com. Now let's get back to the show. And we're live now with Indigenous People's Perspectives with Diane Hill. Let's bring her on to reintroduce herself, her show, her guest, and what's up for today. Welcome back, Diane.
Thanks, Nicole. So today, for my show, Indigenous People's Perspective, I've invited Doug George. He's from the Ojibwe Nation at the Kettle and Stony Point First Nation here in Ontario. He's a Lynx Clan member of that Ojibwe band, and he's recently gotten a new position. And in his new position, which he's going to tell us a little bit more about, they had the opportunity to do a special honoring on September 30th, which was the National Day for Truth and Reconciliation. So I thought it was a good topic that we should cover and take a look at different perspectives, and the perspective certainly that Doug brings on truth and reconciliation. And so I'm inviting back today Doug George.
Well, thank you, Diane.
Hello, Doug.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you now. Thank you.
Okay.
Hello, Doug.
Hello.
Okay, I haven't been able to hear you. Okay.
Can you hear me
so
now?
Doug, yes, we can hear you now. So, Doug, can you tell us what your new job is and where are you located now?
Oh yes, I'm now in the city of Sarnia. I work for the Bluewater Health Hospital, and I am the Indigenous Relations and Navigator Coordinator for the hospital.
Wow, that's a mouthful. That's a lot. It's
yeah.
A big title. So how does that work, that your new position, how does it segue or connect to the National Day of Truth and Reconciliation?
Well, with kind of role here in the hospital, one of the mandates is to implement some of the recommendations of the National Truth and Reconciliation Commission report came out a while back. And so my position is linked right up to, I meet with the CEO, I meet with the managers throughout the hospital, and also I interact with a lot of our Anishinaabe people or our Indigenous people coming through the doors. I do some navigation work also, like in the mental health, or do coverage for our other Indigenous navigators that work in the system here. on residential withdrawal management, and also with our general medicine unit, and throughout the hospital. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done. So for me, it's been a big learning curve here, working in a system other than that's not Indigenous. It's a large system, it's a large business, but it's not Indigenous, and so it's a lot of the training and going through the policies and the procedures and watching the everyday interaction on how people treat Indigenous people coming into the hospital for care.
Okay. So this sounds like a hospital initiative that took action, we'll say, in response to that National Day of Truth and Reconciliation, which was the federal government put it into action on September 30th. And so the other name for that day was called Orange Shirt Day. And I remember Orange Shirt Day was the experience and of a Phyllis Webstad, I believe is her name. And she is a Shuswap native person from the Canoe Creek Indian Band in British Columbia. And Phyllis told her story about being excited to go to school back when she was younger in her early days and wearing and purchasing an orange shirt, going to school because she wanted her first day of school. You know, everybody gets new clothes. Everybody wants to look nice on their first day of school. And she remember reporting to the residential school in her area, and they said they stripped her of her orange shirt and she never saw it again. And so orange shirt became the emblem or the representation of survivors of residential school system. And the orange shirt also became, a symbol of Phyllis's story for which she's traveled and she's told and talked to people about it because she was bringing awareness and education to people across Canada about the treatment of First Nations people, of Native Indian children who are going to these residential schools and many of them not coming home, many of them not surviving. But also that, they took it one step further, I believe, with the federal government honored and acknowledged, right, through a couple of commissions and inquiries and looking into the impact of Indian residential schools on Native people. And that's that report, I think, that you're talking about, which was the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which eventually, I think, the culmination of all these activities led to the establishment of the September 30th National Day of Truth and Reconciliation. So that day happened this past Saturday, and I'm just wondering if the hospital put that, your job created your position in response to a call for action for the betterment of treatment or better treat Native people. Like, how do you see that? What is your perspective on that?
I think it was prior to me being here, there was another individual, Nikki George, who was really responsible for the pioneering the project because it was never in the hospital prior to that. But the hospital did create out of its own funds a position for the Indigenous patient navigator. And that was in response to the Truth and Reconciliation Report and also a recognition that there's still a lot of racism, things that they could do internally within the hospital, Indigenous people that are coming through the door. So I use Indigenous because that's the buzzword that they're using nowadays. But, for me, I just say all our Anishinaabe relatives that are coming through the door, they recognize that they were still having feelings and issues and fears about coming into the hospital, and we still recognize that there's stats that are out there that are published across Canada, which shows that Indigenous people have the higher incidences of sickness and chronic illness and family violence and all kinds of issues, touching on maternal child and healthcare, education, right across the board. And so the hospital took the initiative to hire an Indigenous patient navigator to help with implement some of those truth and reconciliation recommendations. However, her role became so quickly taxed because of all the busyness and the requirements required from Indigenous patient navigators. So really, Indigenous patient navigators are quite worked in the hospital because they're running from here to there, and they still have to do all of the requirements for reporting and reviewing policies and sitting on various committees. And then there's also the pull of participation on committees with some of the communities outside the hospital, particularly First Nations communities and some of the friendship centers within the urban centers, and any other organizations, you know, that are looking for Indigenous representation. But you'll find that with any organization where they have Indigenous people, but more so within the hospital setting, because it's almost like people take that as a given, participate on all these particular committees. But I think the Indigenous patient navigators throughout Southwest Ontario, you'll find them in all of the major hospitals from Windsor to London, Sarnia here, and right across through the Toronto area. And I think if you went and asked them, they're all really taxed for time and resources. And there's just not enough people to go around. And it's so when I'm coming through to the hospital here, I look around and, you know, like, they're quite proud of what they've accomplished so far. And I look around and I tell them, well, that's a nice start. You know, like, it's a nice beginning kind of thing, right? Because, you know, there's always potential for more. And
right.
There's always potential to create bigger, stronger bridges, I think, towards Indigenous communities many other things that we have to take a look at. But it's just impossible for one single person to drive that all within the system, or the great system, I guess some of you would call it, the medical system, and make substantial differences. So it takes teamwork kind of thing. And I think that's only now starting to happen, where the patient navigators within the roles in the hospitals are starting to come together and talking about various issues and streams and sharing information within their systems. So one of the linkages that Indigenous navigators are able to make within the hospitals now is the inclusion of the equity, diversity, inclusion, and they added another I on there for indigeneity. So equity, diversity, inclusion, and indigeneity now is what it is, EDII. And so that's where we're able to interact with others who are marginalized or oppressed within the system itself, such as LGBTQ 2++. You've also got people of color, you know, people, immigrants from other countries, you know, like, that are coming into the system, and a lot of them face their own marginalization, racism, et cetera. So I think the advantage of that was that the Indigenous navigation orders internally would have allies or potential to create allies to combat some of these issues that are in the hospital. So that racism is not only, it also comes externally outside from, you know, people coming in the hospital. So we've had reports where people of color who are working as nurses, say, went to go help somebody and they didn't want to see them because they were black or they were Hispanic, or we've even had our patient navigators go in to people who thought the referral thought they were Indigenous, but they weren't, and they said they didn't want an Indian looking after them, those types of things. So racism still is there, and it still exists. And so they tried to combat that within the organization itself. Everybody knows that racism is still, you know, like, under the table sometimes, you know, like coming in from the public, some of them are a little bit more open about their racism kind of thing. So it's not so bad here in Sarnia. We do know it exists, though. It's not that bad as it appears to be in some other districts across Ontario, though.
You're challenged with providing services for Native people, right? First Nations people, and you're now been expanded to provide service for people of other marginalized groups, people of color, LGBTQ2S+. Is that what I heard you say? So you're challenged to provide these services?
No, it's not. We're not providing services specifically to that, but we're aligning the services so that we're aligning into equity, diversity, inclusion, and we were able to accommodate an addition to that, indigeneity. So where that opens up, you know, like the role of Indigenous Navigation Services to provide education and help and experience with other marginalized groups within the hospital, which includes employees, et cetera. Yes. And in turn, they're, you know, like they're linking up with our group as experts in the field also.
Yeah, because there would be prejudice against all of the groups, eh? Against and racism that you would be encountering with all groups, like people, representatives of each one of those groups you identified. I would assume that they too would be experiencing racism in hospital services and, you know, this kind of thing happening. And so now you can kind of compare notes and you can kind of maybe form some alliance and get education out further, or how is that working?
Like I said, these are all really relatively new initiatives. So with the EDII group, Equity, Diversity, Inclusion, Indigeneity group, that's relatively new. So it's bringing all these groups together in partnership internally, but also we have people from other hospitals who are now linking in and wanting to also share information and you know, like form groups with each other so that they could share some of the information they have, but also to be able to, I guess, just unburden themselves with some of the issues they have within the hospitals themselves. I'm fortunate to be working in a very supportive hospital who is very open to creating change, although they know that there's resistance within the hospital itself to change. And but other workers in other hospitals are having to do a lot more work because they're having to convince their leadership and their managers that the change is for the better kind of thing, right? So because there's various reasons for that, you know, because the hospitals, of course, are always of this big business kind of thing. So people are thinking differently. They're not thinking in terms of impacts of residential school, or they're not thinking in terms of healing and wellness. They're thinking in terms of dollars and cents and, you know, like on what impact any of these changes are going to have to their organization. So I hope that makes sense to everybody, all your listeners.
Yeah. So like you said, it's a start, right? It's a start, but they're still looking at it from the dollars and cents point of view as opposed to the healing. I think the truth part of it would have been out and said that everybody is in agreement that there was a travesty and a terrible thing that happened when Native people were sent to residential school, and it's created all these health problems now, intergenerational stress and intergenerational health problems. I think the hospital administration is aware of that aspect of it in terms of the truth, but I think it's a little bit difficult yet and a little bit foggy in terms of how people are kind of moving forward and looking at, well, what does that mean? How do we reconcile those issues? And what is our part to play in those issues? Because rather than looking at it as healing, let's look at strategies that we can do to heal the relationship between Native and non-Native people. But you're saying that there's a dollar and cents kind of cloak that gets put over top of that, those strategies, right? It could be more about healing and reconciliation, but they're all worried about the dollars and cents. It's kind of how I heard you. It's kind of how I'm looking at it. That in general speaking, not about just your hospital, but in general.
Yeah, in general. Just working within the hospital system myself, I'm learning a lot. So I'm learning that some hospitals have far more funding than others, kind of thing, right? And so some hospitals do have the capability of creating more positions, you know, like internally within our systems, but also they don't have really, you know, like the backup that they need from the provincial or the federal government to also, you know, like add to some of those to some of the funding that's required for healthcare for Indigenous people. With you know, like with our healing, we still have you know, like we still have the Ontario Health West group in Ontario who's still aligning themselves and trying to figure out how they're going to operate internally themselves. They just now recently hired some Indigenous people, some Anishinaabe people, to in their manager roles at the Ontario Health West, and so they're trying to figure out how they're going to be able to support both the, you know, like the First Nations communities off reserve membership and also hospitals. So they don't have that aligned. So there's lots of meetings yet to come with regards to this. And so trying to figure this out, like I said, is really relatively new. There were 94 calls to action through the Truth and Reconciliation Report. And so many of those calls to action were centered around justice, the justice system, and education, child and youth, and so healthcare. You'll see that healthcare was in the Truth and Reconciliation Report, but probably not as many calls to action as were some of the other categories that were out there.
Right.
So
health can only just hire people to represent them as the hospital's initiative in good faith and goodwill is to be able to say, we hired someone to handle, to interface with, and to provide service to Native people. But you're also saying that you also have to provide service and education in terms of the staff of hospitals as well, right? So I'm kind of getting this picture of, this big system, as you call it, but there's so much work that has to be done in terms of even educating people about what a service would look like and how we would adjust it, and how we would change our services to Native people.
That's right. So if you were to just take a look at some of the calls to action relating to health services for Indigenous people, you'll see that there was number one is an acknowledgement that the current state of Indigenous people is a direct result of the government policies, right? And to recognize and implement healthcare rights identified in international law, constitutional law, and within our original treaty documents that we had created, our ancestors created. They also talked about establishing measurable goals to identify and close the gaps in healthcare outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of those are related to like some of the issues that really are what do you call them, the social determinants of health is the word that a lot of people use, but it's just the things that we struggle with, you know, in order to keep alive within First Nations communities. So you're looking at health issues. How many people have boil water advisories? I just, in Kettle Point, we just came out of a boil water advisory yesterday, and that
yeah.
was for 1 week. You know, like this is Southwest Ontario. Also, you know, like you have people, the cost of food, and you have people on fixed incomes, you know, trying to make a go at it for a month, 1 month at a time, you know, like trying to store up enough food to feed their families for a whole month at a time. Infant mortality rates are up, suicide rates are up, mental health issues are up. The big one that everybody's trying to figure out how to deal with too within our communities is addictions and the
opioid
crisis that comes along with that. So there's
That's
all
huge.
Those things. So it is. It's recognizing all those gaps in care, and you know, like coming up with how you know, like how do we close those gaps, right? And
is that your
so
job?
It's not my job, but these are issues that come up at the meetings that I sit at, you see.
Uh-huh.
And so
right.
that is where the reconciliation process comes in. So we identify those gaps, but quite often those gaps, conversations about healthcare gaps are centered around people in general and not specifically to Indigenous people. So, you know, like which
uh-huh.
is problematic.
Yeah, that's like muddying the water. That's like saying, well, you guys have these gaps, but so do these groups too. So the impression I got was let's lump it all together and try and devise some kind of solution to close the gaps. And it sounds like that's really not happening.
Yeah. And then there's the funding arrangements, which cause a lot of disparity for Indigenous people across Ontario. If you're status Indian, non-status Indian, that determines what you qualify for. If you're on reserve or off reserve, that determines what you qualify for. If you're Métis, that's going to determine another category. You know, so
that's
all
where
of these,
the numbers come in.
Yeah, that's where all the numbers come in. So so this causes a huge gaps for service for Indigenous people that are coming into the program. And quite often we find ourselves trying to find referral sources for people who require, you know, like extra help because hospitals can't keep people very long anymore. Not like the old days where you could spend a lot of time in here, you know, like they're just the way things are right now, you know, like they've got categories where they have to kind of move you in and move you out as quickly as possible.
Right.
So
Native people could still get lost in the cracks between, you know, services if they have to be in and out. And so that's sort of like the blanket way that they do business, right? That the hospital does business and provides service. So that again, it might not consider the actual needs of First Nations people. If you're in a critical care position, you have to stay longer. Is there any what consideration given to that, or is it still just like the hospital's policy? And so, we're aware that you might need longer time, but you still, here's the policy because we have to move people in and out.
Yeah, no, they would give consideration, but they would be under pressure to try to find, you know, like referral sources for people. Elderly people are particularly vulnerable in that regard, eh? Because quite often, you know, like they might not have any family members there. And then resources within the community are already limited. Sometimes they do have families, but families are just not in the position or may not want to look after their elderly family members anymore.
Yes.
So even our
mm-hmm.
value systems have changed now. And so this puts particular strain on those particular people, because then it, I don't know if you recall a few years ago where the province of Ontario were sending residents during the COVID-19 crisis, they were sending residents far, like miles away from their home communities. Not just Indigenous people, but that was just elderly people in general. Caused a lot of confusion for them because they were miles and miles away from home, and they didn't have, you know, people couldn't just travel that distance to visit their people, right?
I remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's still the huge gaps. What I hear you saying is that there's still a huge gaps in service, and so you can't even get to any other issues around reconciliation when people are struggling just to fulfill and provide service. And
yes.
So you can't even really get to any other conversation. It sounds like
No. That's
kind of the picture.
No. So right now, you know, like all I could do is I could just really focus internally within the hospital system itself. I don't have the funding, or we don't have the resources to provide outpatient services from the hospital. And of course,
yes.
like the First Nations are looking for outpatient services from the hospital, but we can't provide it because
yeah.
we don't have the funding.
Right.
So it's just this never ending cycle. But so
it's incredibly frustrating. It would be frustrating to you. Wow.
Yeah. In my role, though, within the hospital, is I can look for those people within the system who, here in Sarnia anyways, who can affect change. And some of those things is, like the issues right at hand that you really want to deal with, I guess, is, racism. Unconscious bias. Unconscious bias is a relatively new word to non-Indigenous people. Indigenous people understand unconscious bias.
we're the recipients of the we're the recipients of unconscious bias. But how do they see it, or do they see it?
I did have some feedback once. One of the individuals, like my coworker now, is. Stated, well, how do I know I'm holding unconscious bias if I don't know if it's not conscious? So they're not thinking holistically about it. They're thinking irrationally about it, right? So to them, I can't see unconsciousness. So therefore, it doesn't exist because that's just the way the scientist practitioner model is that you have to prove it, kind of thing, right? In order for it to exist, and that's why they do research, right? This is the challenge of the Truth and Reconciliation Report is one of those things is to get those movers and shakers within the hospital system itself to get the others to recognize the value of Aboriginal or Indigenous healing practices and to use them in part of their treatment, which would also include up to making referrals to Indigenous healers, right? I'm not too sure if you ever had experience in working with doctors generally out in Canada. So we get our feedback. I've been watching the feedback from new Indigenous doctors coming into the system. So we don't have any we have no Indigenous doctors, I don't believe, working for Blue Water Health. However, there are young Indigenous doctors who have come out of medical school. They started medical school with the idea or the concept that I'm going to go learn to be a doctor, and I'm going to value my indigeneity, my culture, and my own healing practices, which I'm familiar with already, and I'm going to combine that for the betterment of Indigenous people. And so what they're finding is that right in, as soon as they get in medical school, they're facing the challenges already with regards to stepping outside of the box, so to speak.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's a very strong culturally defined box, and it takes a lot of energy to try to shift that box around and or add anything in it. And that's usually grounded within what you would call a structural bias. That's just a gentler word to use other than structural racism.
I agree, because they would really be keeping that individual in the context of their westernized training, right? They would say, this is the way that medicine is done. And it would take a really strong native person to be able to keep that split, right? To be able to say, well, here's what my culture says, what healthcare is like, but they're in the training program in the university that's saying this is how it is. And so the cultural conditioning is really quite strong, and I could see how a lot of native professionals would lose themselves in that system. And then, you know, because the system will say, this is how we do business, this is how medicine is practiced, this is how it's being done, right? And you'll have to practice it my way if you're going to receive this credential.
And if you get too close, make them feel uncomfortable, then legalities start coming forward. Then you see, the legalities against their profession. But also, this is the difference between implicit bias or implicit racism, where somebody don't like you because you're, you know, like you're an Indian. They're going to tell you, I don't like you because you're an Indian. That's implicit. They're just going to come right out and say it. With structural bias or structural racism, the difference is they're cognizant. They're aware. They're aware of the differences, and they're aware of the actions. But there is no violence or violent treatment out of that.
There's no will. There's no will on their part to accommodate. Yeah. They lack the willingness. There's no will on their part to say, yeah, I'm aware of the differences, and yeah, I'm aware what Native people are saying, but this is how it's going to go.
Yes, that's correct. So far, you know, like hats off to all the indigenous navigators across Ontario who have been able to make some changes, you know, like, and I always say, oh, that's my word. I always say, oh, it's nice. It's a nice beginning. You know, that's a good start, you know, but
yeah.
You know, like we have so much more to do, because indigenous healing ceremonies in terms of health care, healing, wellness, and spirituality are so much more than just smudging. So smudging is very important. It helps. It calms people down. It relaxes people within the system. They're able to do that, which most hospitals are now accommodating to be able to
that's
do
that.
That's
one measure.
But, that's one measure, yes. But there are so many other things that that can be done. So, for example, in indigenous medicine, versus, you know, like some of the other medicines, you know, like maybe that you would get over the counter. I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done also internally within our own groups, within the First Nations, at the First Nations level, on reserve, off reserve, with people, terms of what does healing and wellness mean? What does reconciliation mean? Here at the hospital, I think at any hospital you go to, you're going to see a lot of play out of prejudices, feelings from Indigenous people coming in, fears, you know what I mean? You know, like all the hurts and traumas they got, you're going to see that play out in the emergency department, in critical care unit. Within the hospital, because tensions are already high, and so when you bring people in, you know, like, and everybody's tense, you know, like people just don't have time to be sitting down and being nice to each other, kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
Because because there's so much stress and there's so much work to be done, right? But yet, you know, like our people are coming through the door, and there's on one hand they're justified in being afraid because of all the historical trauma they, you know, like they've come through, right?
So
of course, you know, like they are going to meet up with racist people occasionally, you know, like within the system itself, which could be an impediment to their health care. And as we can see with some of the things that happened to the Echequan case in Quebec and also over in Manitoba, and also more recently closer to home in near Niagara on the lake, we've seen the death of indigenous people right in the emergency care because somebody thought they were coming in for some other issue, or somebody made an assumption on their part about why they're there, and they were just sort of forgotten about and not checked on, et cetera, you know, for various reasons, right? And so these are some of those situations are a result, with the Echequan case in Quebec, that's a direct racism.
What happened there in Quebec? Can you share that?
Well, I don't have all the particulars, but if I recall, the patient was in the hospital for pain that she was having, but when she was in the operating room and she was talking about the pain that she was having, but the nurses were making derogatory remarks about her, you know, like telling her to settle down, and they were talking to each other saying, you know, like, oh, she must be, you know, like drunk or something like that. These types of things, right? Then so although she had her cell phone.
She had a medical condition.
She had a serious medical condition. Yeah.
Yeah, and she couldn't talk, and they thought she was drunk. And then, she taped it, right? Now I remember.
She had her cell phone, and she was able to tape the conversation, and that's where the evidence came through. And had she not had that tape, they probably would have, you know, like it would have probably being marked down as you know, like that she passed away, and you know, like from whatever the medical condition she had, and same with the gentleman, you know, like in, I can't remember his name, but the one in the hospitals in Manitoba, he had a serious diabetes issue, and they pushed him in the chair, and they left him in the emergency department for hours and hours, and they have camera footage showing people walking back and forth. Nobody was engaging with him. Nobody checked on him. It was not until the next morning where they went to go and check on him, and he was already passed away from his condition that he had. So these are like comorbid decisions, or they, you know, like they quite often they have other issues other than what they come into the emergency room for, kind of thing. And the case that was over in Niagara on the Lake area, I think Six Nations is quite involved in that particular case. But that was a young lady who came into the emergency department, and somebody put a note on her file, which they think may have implanted. A thought pattern with other service providers that she was just there looking for maybe, you know, like drugs or et cetera kind of thing, right? And
wasn't she sent home?
Yeah, she was sent home, and then she came back again, and she did end up passing away also. So that's very recent.
In the emergency room.
Yes, I think that's very, very recent, and so recent that there was a report that was actually just released August, I think it was.
Yeah.
And now they're still trying to contemplate how are we going to deal with this now, and you know, like what are the expected outcomes of this, right? So with regards to that, so they would have went through their internal investigations at the hospital, and that report that was released, it was
It included a panel of elders and I think people from Six Nations and also staff at the hospital. So that would have came out with some recommendations with it, you know, like in terms of where to go forward. But I think there's some more work to be done on that.
Oh, there's lots of work to be done on so many areas in so many ways. That's what I think in the time that we have left here, Doug, I think looking at, you know, this, you've painted a pretty good picture for our listeners to understand just how pervasive this, I'll use your words, unconscious bias is, right, that people make assumptions about people of not of First Nations, not just First Nations, but people of color and LGBTQ2S+ members. Everybody's sort of been the victim of this unconscious bias which, you know, people have to start to wake up, and it isn't until you start having these kinds of cases come forward where people die, and then suddenly, you know, now you're in the news, and now, you know, the truth is coming out, and it's like people have to sort of start looking, well, how did that happen? Like, what is your role? How did you contribute to that or not contribute to that situation? So do you think it's ever going to be resolved? Like, these kinds of stories and these kinds of situations have been going on for a long, long time. It's just that they're coming out more and more in the news. And, you know, blessings to the people, you know, and who have lost their lives for the betterment, I think. Like, there's stories, that lady's video, right, in the Quebec case, help push the issue to the surface. Do you think it's ever going to be resolved, that people are going to wake up and start looking at different kinds of services and working more in partnership with Native people? Do you think there's in your lifetime, are you going to see that?
Well, I was hoping in my young lifetime, I was hoping that I would see it in this lifetime, but I really, I'm going to be 60 years old pretty soon. And, you know, like, and when I reflect back on my lifetime, I've seen some movement, right? Because in my young life, I grew up in a time where prejudice was pretty blatant out there in public.
Yeah.
It still is, but, you know, like people don't talk about it like they used to, you know, like where they just came out and just, you know, like said things unashamed of what they're saying to you a long time ago, you know, like where they would just right from school age, you know, like where they would call you names that we don't usually hear them anymore, but they're out there, you know, like they would call you Wahoo or Wagon Burner, you know. So these were racisms that were perpetuated through media, even right from cartoons right into public school, and then these are things that we have to live with, right?
Do you think it's better than those things you grew up with?
I don't know if it's better if I'm not concentrating on those things anymore, because you go through a process of healing and then you shift your thought process and what you focus on, right? However, I am seeing a lot more allyship is what I call it, allyship. So you have non-Indigenous people who are trying to stand up and create, you know, like these changes on behalf of Indigenous people, right? Because they themselves recognize the importance of moving forward with all this. So I've seen a large group, you know, like move into those positions, you know, like although there needs to be a lot more people doing it. Growing up in the First Nations community, I see that our own people within First Nations communities have a lot of work that they still have to do on themselves. Although healing and wellness has been around for years now, and I recall you, Diane, have been working in the healing and wellness and created a healing and wellness model out there, and you've been doing that now for what, like 3, 4, 5 decades?
Yeah.
So you're, and,
yeah.
And you're only now seeing, you know, like more and more people, albeit it's usually the women that are coming into larger groups to recognizing that they want to heal, you know, like in terms of what they're seeing and what they're feeling and what they're experiencing within their communities and within their families and what they're seeing within their own children. So they don't want to do that. They don't want to carry that trauma and that pain forward, but they also know that trauma and pain has been there so long that they're likely to be healing for the rest of their life, when these things come up for them, eh?
Yeah.
And so I think that that's like a taking a look at things in a micro way, and then I take a look at the hospital settings where you have many people coming through the doors and like from various different walks of life, and I ask myself quite often, you know, like I wonder if these people understand the concepts of Indigenous healing and wellness. Even if I drop the Indigenous part of it, and we talk about healing and wellness in terms of spirit.
Mm-hmm.
If I bring even the concept of spirit, it's totally, other than isolating it towards, say, a spiritual event, you'd like going to church on Sunday, and adhering to maybe some of the, like if you're a Christian, adhering to some of the biblical practices within the book, but actually living within the concept of making spirit as a part of who you are and reflecting on it and revolving your whole life around that energy, because you know that energy is the thing that's going to fuel the healing and the wellness within the whole system right out to the physical body, right? And then beyond.
Yeah.
And those conversations just aren't happening here. So everything is really very physically based, physically motivated. Like I said, it's like evidence-based. Seeing is believing. Spirituality is not anything that we learned. We're not comfortable with it. It's nice that you people practice that, but, you know, like it's something,
yeah,
you know, like that I wouldn't want to deal with in my everyday work is what I'm hearing.
Yeah.
These things I've also heard non-Indigenous people go through a little bit of education with regards to some of the issues that Indigenous people have faced in their history, and so they'll listen to you, but there's no life experience for them. There's no feeling. There's no spiritual connection to all that. You'll see some of them, they'll feel it because they can resonate that experience maybe to something that their family has